Hugh Atchison, and this is Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot. On today's show, I visit food writer Andrew Friedman at the storied Gotham Bar and Grill in Greenwich Village. Friedman is a longtime collaborator with Gotham chef Alfred Potale, and we talk a lot about that restaurant's just seminal imprint on New York City and the New York City food scene. It's been there for 35 years. I mean, it's a pretty seminal place, and it's a real icon in the industry, and it's really interesting to chat about it. If you're enjoying Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot, please rate it and write a review on your podcast app. That'll help other people find the show. If you're a first-time listener, please subscribe and download other episodes like Tom Colicchio Heats Up Leftovers. Colicchio did work at Gotham Bar and Grill once upon a time. And last week's episode was Dan Barber Plants a Seed. Here's this week's conversation. Andrew Friedman eats at Gotham. I'm in Manhattan. I'm on 12th Street. And I'm in Gotham Bar and Grill, which is a temple of fine dining in many respects. Alfred Portal's restaurant. And it is a powerhouse of classic upscale New York. And I'm talking today with Andrew Friedman, who most recently wrote Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, which is a really amazing book about chefdom in America and the kind of creation of the celebrity chefs and that era of 70s to 80s that sort of fomented into what we consider chefdom today and laid so many trails for so many of us to follow in the next generation. But Andrew, it's good to have you here.
It's an honor to be here, Hugh. Thanks for having me.
This is an amazing restaurant. You've got a lot of history here. You've worked with Alfred throughout the years on many projects.
You co-authored 3 cookbooks with him.
3 books.
He was the first person who ever hired me who paid me money to write anything.
Wow, that's a good gig.
Yes.
Opened a lot of doors then.
Yes.
So your book came out about a year ago, and it's a great read.
Thank you very much.
It's a really interesting read.
Thank you very much.
Hey, geez, I mean, the stories of chefdom are crazy, but I find the ascension, the most interesting one to me is the ascension of Wolfgang Puck in Los Angeles, which was so interesting from Mama's Own. Then opening up Spago and the issues with the owner of Mamazon, and who's really retired into obscurity in South Carolina now, of all places, or in Georgia or something like
that. In Georgia.
He's near me.
He's near you. He's right off 85.
Yeah, which is strange that's everything is so close and in range. But that, and then Barbara Lazaroff's really impact on Wolfgang's career, who he later was married to. It struck me as a lot of these stories in the book are really about the delicate catastrophe that the restaurant openings are.
Yes.
And then also paired with, in that day and age, the extreme amount of personal abuse that people are putting themselves through after shifts and stories of addiction. And it's struck me as the industry's really, I think, changed in a lot of regards.
Oh, yeah.
There's been a lot of impact and people getting clean. But are chefs taking it more seriously now, or they just have better systems, or why are we in a better position in chefdom today than we were back then? Because it just seems so frenetic.
I mean, I think there's so many ways to look at that question, because I think a lot of people who hear that question might think you're referring to, you know, the stories of the reckoning or the Me Too movement, which I don't think you actually are. I think you're talking about the rigors of the job, the way people, drank and did drugs after hours.
Which still exists.
The way you got treated in a kitchen,
right.
The yelling, screaming, pan-throwing chef, which was totally accepted, right? And I'm told things are actually better here in the U.S. than they are in some other countries today.
That culture still exists elsewhere.
Yeah, and I think actually for all that we, or most of us sort of lament it and make fun of it. I think in some ways it's sort of a extension of this litigious society we live in, right? We now are in a place where if you're going to call people about a name on the line, if you're going to, certainly if you're going to throw something at them, definitely if you're going to hit them, which people think that's a joke. That happened a lot.
Oh, yeah.
You know, hey, chef, I think it might be a good idea if you did the dish this way. You might get slapped for that back in the day.
Yeah, I ducked some pots back in the day.
But that stuff here in the U.S. now with the legal system, with HR departments, with all the checks and balances, that's not okay. Whether morally, you can even set the morally aside. It's just not tenable. It's you could get sued into oblivion.
But then a lot of older chefs say that the school of hard knocks really creates better chefs who understand the duress of the job.
Well,
but I think that's a false war they're waging. That's such an emasculated version of chefdom that doesn't need to exist. But then again, maybe it does. I think, you know, if I think back on some of my women contemporaries or mentors, Tracy Desjardins leading Joachim Spiekel's restaurant in L.A. back in the day as a chef de cuisine, as a woman in her 20s, I could see Tracy being a hard ass.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not necessarily an emasculated world in that way that I think is completely gone. But I think that now it's in tandem with the litigious aspect of the world, but it's also with, I don't think you can staff a kitchen that way under that duress.
Here's what I think is interesting. You know, like, somebody once asked a doctor I saw being interviewed, you know, who experiences pain more intensely, men or women, right? And the doctor said, well, you can't know that, right? Because men have only experienced it as men and women have only experienced it as women. And I think by the same token, you know, I do know plenty of chefs and the stereotype would be that these are men, but you just mentioned Tracy Desjardins. I know plenty of women chefs. I had Victoria Blamey on my podcast, who at the time was the chef at Chumley's in New York. And she came up in fine dining restaurants, mostly in Europe and a little in Australia. And she believes that kitchens are too soft today. Not that she believes in the violent physical part of it, but that people need to be pushed. You know, certainly chefs of the generation I write about in my book, those people all believe, whether they'll say it publicly or not, as Jack Nicholson says in A Few Good Men, all you did was weaken a country today. You know, like, they believe cooks don't know what it is to push. You know, really push.
But it's funny.
But what I was going to say is that generationally, right, the more enlightened, the kinder, gentler generation, I'm sure feels like they're getting great results, right? The older generation probably feels like the cooks in those kitchens can't push the way they did, but we'll never know.
You will never know. And
because
I think
these people have completely different experiences.
I think that's always the older generation always says that about the younger generation, regardless of the industry. Yeah, you didn't work hard enough. You're not.
Right.
You don't know how it used to be in push.
Right.
But it's funny that type of regimented brigade system that's documented in the book and the advent of in the ascent of fine dining, in the ascent of chefdom in the United States is really morphing out of, in a lot of the examples, morph out of the dawning of the age of Aquarius and hippiedom and the 60s and early 70s. And the freewheelingness and the sort of, you know, releasing of your mind and all this stuff. And yet we get these hard-ass chefs coming out of it. That seems like completely polar opposite of that type of mentality.
Yeah, well, I mean, to me, it's interesting. What you just referred to me is very much the West Coast view of things. And by and large, kitchens were more evolved on the West Coast than they were on the, say, from Chicago East, right? So you did a lot of the kitchens in North. First of all, it's kind of singular among Western culinary hubs. The Bay Area, back in this time I write about in the book, was basically dominated by women. I mean, it really was. If you look at it, there were, you know, you had Alice Waters and Judy Rogers and Joyce Goldstein and Barbara Trop and Nancy Oakes and Patricia Unterman. And sure, there were guys who got, you know, there was Jeremiah and there was Gary Danko. But like, it was, you could really argue that town was run by women, you know. And I remember interviewing Nancy Silverton for my book and saying, starting to ask her if she had any sort of horror stories as a woman back then. And she's cut me off and said, I know where you're going with this, and I don't have any horror stories. And this is someone who started cooking in the 70s, only in California, right? I think the East Coast, as much as, and I think this is why the food in California kind of progressed a little more quickly, right? Because it was people expressing themselves and not following rules, not going to cooking school, not having formal training. The East Coast, to me, the more sort of archetypical East Coast chef was, you know, the agricultural blue-collar kid from, you know, somewhere in the tri-state area who got a job as a dishwasher, wasn't a very good student, was drawn to the kitchen first, and then sort of became obsessed with sort of basically pleasing these French masters. You know, happy to sort of learn the Escoffier playbook. You know, their creativity.
In a lot of ways,
their creativity came a little later. You know, they weren't the hippies; they were the sort of the academic, the people who I say were metabolically incompatible with formal education.
And then
a lot of the people in California were like in graduate school when they dropped out to become chefs.
Yeah, I guess the more East Coast, well, Chicago to East Coast example of that I can think of is the most famous sort of academic dropout was Charlie Trotter.
Right.
Moving from academics, deep academics at the time, to doing very highfalutin food and really starting off as almost like your first little pop-up chef.
Right.
Prior to that being a term.
Right.
So it's interesting that the East Coast chef phenomena, you're talking about, you know, the progress made while West Coast was sort of early on, you know, the nascency of the regionalism, California cuisine really bursting out with Wolfgang and then people like Tracy and Alice Waters and all those folks really evoking something new and definitely cooking from their own backyard. New York never really had that moment up until recently where you're cooking all from the Green Market. And not to diss New York at all, but, you know, the farmers of the Green Market are 8 hours away up in the Hudson Valley, yeah, near the Canadian border. So it's not exactly regional food. It's pretty, I can drive across three states in 8 hours down south. So it's a different perspective of regionalism. So progress to me on the East Coast was made much through for lack of a better term, the ascendancy of ethnic food and the playfulness of other cultural food within New York,
mm-hmm,
and Chicago and places like that. Whereas California, that is more happening now. They've got all this other progress that they made in the development of California food and the regionalism of utilizing their larder there.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That's just popping up in my head.
The only sort of gloss I would put on that is I think one of the things that did happen here, and I think it was an outgrowth of these young cooks and going over doing what we would call a stage or an unpaid apprenticeship overseas and seeing the amazing product, right? There's a lot of misunderstanding about this. Most people's reference points were French, right? The people in California, yeah, were looking toward French.
Yep.
The people in New York wanted to start getting their hands on great product, not because of Chez Panisse. It was because of what they were seeing over in France, right? And I think the commitment to product was another big part of the New York story. Not that it came from as close by as it did in California, but a guy like Larry Forgione working
was
the phones
seeking
and
out.
Finding superlative stuff from all over the country and then having it shipped to JF. This is pre-FedEx, right? Buzzy O'Keefe, the owner of the River Cafe, used to send a van to JFK Airport a few times a week to pick up Larry's shipments, right? Barry Wine had the Quilted Giraffe with his wife Susan, and at their home up or their property in New Paltz, they had a farm that supplied their restaurant in the city. People don't remember, you know, they remember California for product. They don't remember these sort of stories.
Right.
So I do think the commitment to getting their hands on great product and not using, as a lot of people said to me, you know, only what was available on the purveyor's order sheet, was a big step in the quality of the building blocks coming up in New York.
So where is New York food now? What are we seeing happening within the city of New York that's really exciting to you?
You know, for me...
And does it have a future with rents and...
Well, the rent thing is crazy. The staffing issue is real. You know, there's about to be a project opening up. I'm blanking on the name. Over on the west side, Hudson Yards.
Mm-hmm.
And I think 35 restaurants are going to open there in a couple of months. Like, there's zero restaurants right now. And then we're all going to wake up one day. There's going to be 35 new restaurants. Where are those people? Where are those people coming from who work there? You know, and the Red Cat closed after 18 years. 19 years almost.
Jimmy Bradley,
my old podcasting co-host and good friend. Battersby closed in Brooklyn on New Year's Eve. The Flatiron Lounge, not a restaurant, but an important bar, just shuttered. The Half King Bar and restaurant in Chelsea closed. And it just keeps coming. I mean, it is really, really crazy. For me, everything you and I both just said, the upshot is I think people who are spending a lot of money on restaurants have gotten very conservative in what they're doing. I think there's a lot of sameness in the food, to be honest. I think, a couple of years ago, Eater did a thing. It was like it called every trendy restaurant menu. Did you see it?
No.
It was a menu.
Okay.
And it was so on the, it was like the chicken for two. And then it had sides and it was like carrots that did a semester in Indonesia. And it had a kale salad at the time. And it really spoke to...
Charred leek dust.
This kind of thing. But it spoke to the real, this sort of sameness that I think you see in the food, which I understand. I think a lot of people are hedging their bets, right? Then I think in direct opposition to that, you're seeing the food that really speaks to me, that's intriguing to me, are people who are sort of mining either their own or a different culture. I know that can get to be a hot topic, but you know, I look at like my friend Jonathan Wu, unfortunately had to close his restaurant Fung Tu, but he was, you know, here was a guy who had worked at Per Se, who had worked for Eric Repair.
Fung Tu was, I went there initially when they opened early, but then they had to close for a long time because of some issue with water or something.
No, it was a gas thing. They stayed open through that. They were using little propane demo.
That's right. Okay.
Things. Yeah, crazy.
The food was great, though.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
You know, and here was a guy who was a Chinese-American, you know, and grew up with Chinese grandparents and took those reference points and took this formal training and created this utterly unique food, you know. I look at what, like, Enrique and Daniela are doing at Cosme and at Atla. You know, that is tremendously exciting to me. I also look at what an American like Alex Stupak is doing with Mexican food.
Who is angrily cooking Mexican food.
But no, I find his food...
Alex is a...
I think to me
a
what...
Tasmanian devil of Mexican food.
I think what's going on at Empeón Midtown is just...
Oh, it's phenomenal. It's
brilliant.
It's phenomenal.
It's brilliant.
And I think you're right about Atla. Atla is just paving a way for a whole new understanding of traditional food in this beautiful modernist setting. And it's small and it's tiny, but it's so, it's inexpensive and yet it's so pro and so honed.
Yeah.
And that's, that transference of fine dining ideals to something as simple as a breakfast, lunch, and early dinner spot is kind of the future for me. It's like, how do you get the eight turns you need in a New York restaurant to make it happen? Well, that's the classic example of how you do it progressively.
Yeah, well, it also, to me, the thing that I had this revelation, because I've been promoting this book, so I've been doing a lot of talks on the road, and they all have a Q&A, and I get the crystal ball question a lot. And, you know, I had this epiphany one day, which is, you know, why are there's too many restaurants, really, right? And what does that mean? What it means is that it's not supply and demand, right? Like, you go back to this time I write about in the book, there were not that many really important, noteworthy restaurants, right? So it was hard to get into them. It was a buyer's market in terms of staffing, right? It was a chef's market, not a cook's market. And that worked really well. And then there was a time, I think, where things were at the perfect equilibrium. The reason there's so many restaurants is not supply and demand. It's because there are so many young people who want to be in the restaurant business. There are people who want to be chefs. There are people who want to be sommeliers. There are people who want to be owner restaurateurs. there are more of those people in a city like New York than there are diners to patronize all the restaurants these people can open. So you with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
So what I think that means is we're seeing it with all these closings. I think it means people are more fickle than they used to be, the diners, because they can be. I think it means very few restaurants. We're sitting in a restaurant that's been here for 34 years. And I interviewed the guys, Jeremiah and Fabian, who have Contra and Wild Air. And it was around the time that Gotham and Tribeca Grill, all these restaurants, were turning 30. And I said to them, do you envision something like that for yourselves? And they said, if we get through 5 years, and at the time, they were the hottest restaurant in town. If we get through 5 years, we'll feel like we did well. That's, I think, where the mindset is for younger
cooks.
They're
still doing pretty well, though. And they're empire building, those guys, Wild Air and Contra. And they've got Una Pizza Napolitana.
Yes, they do.
And,
but my point is
I think
is
they've
that
got a couple of other things on the radar. But I think that that's a generational shift, that they're going for current and contemporary. They're not aiming for icon status.
No. But I also feel like what's going to happen is, I think, and we're already seeing this, really you're going to see an elevation of the quality and variety of chefs in what were traditionally B markets, because not everybody will be able to be in New York, San Francisco, Chicago. That's already happening. It's already happening. I think you're going to start to see specializations. I think there's going to be chefs who are just pop-up chefs. You know, maybe there's not a spot for them in a certain city, but they can have a show that goes on the road and they can sustain themselves that way. And people doing food trucks. And I think you might see people who are just breakfast and lunch people, you know, I think,
which is the most, to me is, you know, mostly in New York, it's like, how do you pay the rent just doing breakfast and lunch? That's not typically when people drink, and isn't typically when you sell a $500 bottle of wine, which is really the saving grace of a restaurant like Gotham. I mean, it's, you know, is a coaster. Meursault is an important sell in the space of a week to keep them afloat.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. But I agree that enthusiasm of young cooks and the dream of opening up a restaurant is what fuels this amount of restaurants that we have. But then the fear on that is that most young chefs and restaurateurs have no real idea of the economics of restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And that they, you know, the book documents this well. It's kind of feast or famine for a lot of these people. And, you know, it's more often famine in the case of restaurants. So, I mean, we're talking about 4 or 5% profit margins in fine dining.
Right.
You know, if you make a buck at all.
Right.
So it's a really challenging landscape. And the funny thing is, it's not just New York. It's everywhere. I mean, rents in San Francisco are outlandish. Wow. Rents in LA are becoming outlandish. Rents in Atlanta are even high where I am. So it's interesting. So let's talk about celebrity chefdom. And to me, celebrity chefdom as a pervasive endemic plague.
Plague.
I hate that term. So,
which term? Celebrity chef.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it.
I don't use it myself.
It immediately hacks away the legacy and history that these people worked to get to, and the amount of hours that they've put into a craft that pays them little, and then they appear on TV and immediately they're dubbed with a term that's just, to some is a term of endearment and to most is a term of abhorrence. But it does. I don't think it exists in France. I don't think it exists as much in England.
Yeah.
Is it just in the States in our quest to make people B-list and C-list celebrities that we've, you know, why does it exist here?
I think
so much.
Well, I don't know. I think part of the answer maybe is that at the time that term came into existence, right?
When did it come into existence? I'd say, really with the advent of TV? I mean, not the advent of TV, but of food television.
I think that's when it went kind of supernova.
And bam.
Yeah, the early 90s was when I think it really started spreading. I remember, I'm first aware of it maybe in the 80s. There weren't many and retroactively, I mean, you would say Wolfgang Puck was, and Paul Prudhomme was, and Jeremiah Tower was. But, you know, I remember in the old Zagat Guide, there was a category in the back. You know, it was like, you know, meat for a drink, good brunch, celebrity chef. That was actually a category of the restaurants.
Of which my restaurants have gotten that.
So, but to me, I think the notion of an American chef was still a novelty, right? And the profession here was thought of as such a dirty, blue-collar, unskilled, menial kind of thing that I think just calling them chefs almost didn't get across the sea change that had happened here. So it needed a, does that make sense? It needed another modifier. It needed something like, celebrity made it sound glamorous. Celebrity made it sound clean. Celebrity made it sound lucrative. Celebrity made it sound like you'd want to meet these people, you know? Whereas in Europe, that I think years earlier, that would not have been the case. But by the time the change was happening here, people like Paul Bocuse and Alain Chappelle and Michel Girard, these people had become huge superstars.
Yeah, Girard and all those people. But, they, you know, in France now is, you know, and but that's an aging generation of quasi-celebrity chefs in France that are well-known. But is Anne-Sophie Pic, is she a celebrity in France?
I don't think they would. I mean, she's
I think she is.
She is, but I don't think that you would use that term over there.
No, I don't think you would either.
Yeah, for anybody. I just think it's almost superfluous.
Yeah. Yeah, to me, they're held in more professional, higher professional regard. And as soon as we get a celebrity status in the United States, it's kind of a... It doesn't give any sort of credence to the brilliance and wherewithal of that person in their given career.
I only use that term for people who don't actually cook.
Like a Guy Fieri? I mean, he cooks.
Yeah, I mean, no, someone who I don't even want to name.
And
anybody.
I've actually changed my opinion on Guy a lot.
A lot of people have.
Yeah, I think he's,
People like him.
He's grown on
I don't know him. I've never met him.
Stylistically, I think he's a little challenged still.
Right.
But I mean, that's fine.
No, but what I mean is
he needs to go on Queer Eye and get restyled. No, I think that would be a great, I mean, that would be.
So do I.
We
could all do with that.
Guys, people, talk to Queer Eyes, people make this happen.
But but I think it's also a distinctly American thing, you know, this idea that
celebrity.
All of a sudden, celebrity, that's like, you know, one of the things that's like the American dream, you know, and there was something to me about the idea, and also the idea that food here didn't have the respect that it already had in a place like France, you know?
Yeah.
Food itself was coming up. Food
Yes. Was
becoming...
And whether food is even held in reverence in the United States is still up for debate. I mean,
well, if you
definitely
want to talk about
France.
Really, right. I mean, if you want to talk about just the raw numbers. And, you know, I remember interviewing Mr. Stupak last year, a year and a half ago. And, you know, we were talking about his style and this and that. And at some point he said, and by the way, most 99% of restaurants in the world don't care about anything we're talking about.
And he's right.
And he's right. And most diners don't either, right?
Yeah.
It's what Mary Sue Milliken calls the 1% of restaurants that we're, you and I are talking about right now. But, you know, the food here was becoming almost celebrity. You know, a dish like Paul Prudhomme's blackened redfish, that was almost a celebrity dish, you know? It was a whole sea change in just all
and
of
at the
it.
Point, that point in time, it was wild redfish, so they were fished into obscurity.
Yes.
And now they're all farmed.
Yes.
So it's funny that, you know, celebrity status of a dish can get a whole industry in trouble. You know, the popularity of swordfish in the 80s, when we had to stop cooking swordfish for 10, 15 years to let the population come back. So it's amazing that those things can happen, even just covering a 1% 1% situation.
Well, can I ask you, am I allowed? Can I ask you a question?
Yeah, you can ask me. Yes.
Well, you mentioned the celebrity chef thing and your discomfort with it, right? You, mid-career, found yourself all of a sudden on television.
Right.
And you just said your restaurant was in Zagat, had that term.
Yeah, it had that term dubbed to it.
Does it bother you personally?
I think it...
Do you take it as an insult?
It look, the amount of time that I've spent on TV being a chef is probably 0.5% of my working career.
Right.
It has gotten me more attention than anything else I've ever done.
Yep.
Do I think that is... do I feel blessed for that attention? Sure, whatever. Am I proud of it? No, I'm proud of the other 99.5% of what I've done.
Yes.
Because I think it means a lot more. I do not begrudge anything. But yeah, it is you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah. We have food now presented in front of us.
Thank you, gentlemen.
A Gotham Bar and Grill in all its beauty.
Yeah.
It looks like we have some sort of a carbonara.
That's pasta carbonara.
Pasta carbonara.
Yes.
And then we have a brilliant steak with beautiful crisp matchstick fries, a bone marrow flan, roasted garlic, little tiny baby carrots, classic Bordelaise. We're getting presented with wine. We're living it up here.
This is not bad, right?
This is not bad.
Noon yet? No.
Let's talk about the timelessness of food and the chef's idea of, do you constantly need to create as a chef? I mean, you're not a chef, but is there a need to constantly, for the American diner or from a chef's perspective of talking to all these people you've talked to over the years, there always seems to be a difference between, there's a camp of chefs who have a deep affection for the past, and there is a camp of chefs who have a deep affection for the future.
Mm.
Which one's more important? Or are they both?
I think it's case by case. And I also think for some of these people, whether they know it or not, their present is the future. I look at somebody like Jonathan Waxman, right?
Who's known for his chicken at
Barbuda. But also has been doing very much the same style of food.
Since he did at Jams back in the day.
Since he did at Michael's before that in Santa Monica in the late 70s. And it's kind of amazing to me that you go into a place like Barbuda and... you know, that food could have been a lot of it. I mean, some of those dishes were Jams, you know, and it's very classic in that way. And I think he just kind of hit this track of timelessness, you know, just kind of being who he was and following his nose. I think you look at what we're eating here today.
Is very timeless
food. This is timeless food. I mean, this steak dish that you described has been on the menu. I think it was originally with onion rings and not with these shoestring potatoes since this restaurant opened. Or I shouldn't say since it opened. Alfred came in a year later.
Right. And I'm digging into pasta carbonara, which is thoroughly... But that's the difference between, I think, classic food that's timeless is that it's only timeless and sales-worthy if they nail it. And simple food that's been done for 100 years... is not so simple. I mean, nailing a pasta carbonara is not the simplest thing to do because there's so many things that can go wrong with simple food.
Yeah.
But this is a classic example of food that deserves to be on the mantle for a really long time to come.
Well, the other thing is we all take for granted now, right? This is really interesting, right? We have, you know, the steak with the Bordelaise sauce, as you said, and the marrow mustard custard. Now, we have a pasta with this dish, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, there was a time where this was a radical notion, or the idea that, you know, there's a probably on the menu a first course available of risotto, you know, in this restaurant.
Right.
There was a time where that, I remember when the late, great Jonathan Gold, when he was writing for Gourmet, wrote an appreciation of the Gotham and said, you know, if you're appreciative of something like, if you're appreciative of the fact that, you know, you can see on menus around this country now, risotto and pasta and things with, you know, maybe bok choy, and you can thank the Gotham for that, right? And there's something that seems inevitable about these things when they come to pass, you know, like they're sort of radical at the time, but there's also something that seems inevitable. It's like art, right?
Right.
there's something that just seems right about it and unforced about it. But there was a time where this combination that we're having
was
kind of new and exciting and groundbreaking.
And pushing the envelope.
And now it's sort of just what we expect in an American restaurant.
But to me, this is a classic American restaurant. And New York's got so many of them. Union Square Cafe, Gramercy Tavern, Gotham, Kraft. These are all classic American restaurants. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to see where food is going. I would say I am of the type of chef who reveres the past more than the future.
You do?
Yeah.
How do you mean that? You mean you like to sit down to a class, whether it's whatever country it comes from, you like to sit down to a traditional meal?
My quest, yeah, in a lot of ways. But, I mean, I like eating outside of that parameter, but I like cooking in the way. I mean, my quest, until I die, is to make the perfect roast chicken. I make a really good roast chicken. It's awesome. It's beautiful. But it's still a quest to better it, but that's a style of cooking that's been around for 400, 500 years, mm-hmm. Versus, you know, watching Grant Achatz cook at Alinea is more of a push towards the future, or Farron and people like that. So
yeah.
it's a different way of looking at it. I think both perspectives need to be always respected and understood. But I think that we have a dangerous situation sometimes when a lot of young chefs just want to push the envelope without understanding the truth mm-hmm. about the history of food. So it is interesting in the book, you know, about that day, that era of partying chefs and what that beget and what happened and what's happening now. And consequences of actions that are being taken into account. You know, we've got a lot of famous restaurateurs and chefs in New York who are slowly losing empires or barely hanging on to them because of things that they have done that are thoroughly reprehensible. And so it's interesting to see how this is changing our industry and making it. I thoroughly believe that it's going to make the industry better. That it is a time of tumult and coming and of
recalibration.
Recalibration and bringing people to real justice. And some of these people are people historically, I you know, it's difficult to watch people who did these actions like raping people and things who you once held in relatively high esteem. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really painful to see that demagoguery come to the surface. And I guess we were just ignoring it for way too long or just pushing it under the rug or something. But are you seeing a change in things?
Well, I mean, for me, I don't know if people believe this, but other writers have said it, and it was for sure true of me. I never saw this behavior. I saw people drunk, sure. I saw people strung out, sure. But this sort of abuse that has come to light in the last, you know, year plus, I never saw it. You know, I lived about 10 blocks north of the Spotted Pig around the time that it opened. I profiled April for the the Oprah magazine.
Right.
And because I'd written that piece and I interviewed Ken Friedman, I could get in there without a reservation. I mean, they didn't take reservations. I could get in there. I was often invited upstairs to the third floor after dinner to hang out.
Right.
In what is now referred to as the rape room. But when I did my joke was like, and I'm dating myself, you know, is that it was probably like Hogan's Heroes. Like when I was coming, you know, they would, you know, put the bed down over the tunnel and turn the credenza around. And, you know, I never saw any of this stuff. I'm not going to say I was shocked when the stories came out because, you know, I used to be in the film business. I know what people are capable of. I was shocked that people who I knew personally a little bit, you know, Mario Batali is someone who had always been incredibly gracious to me, generous, gave me two interviews for this book.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't even go through his assistant to schedule them. I mean, that's really nice, you know. And then these things came out, and it was a sea change in my view of some of these people.
It's funny that the way that a lot of them are addressing it is just by trying to hide from it. And I don't think you can hide from it. I think that I think the first step is really publicly plotting out a real road to your own personal salvation and how you're going to fix yourself, and that has to be shown to people. You also have to really genuinely apologize in this situation.
You have to find a place of deep humility.
Yeah.
I mean, the term I use, it's a 12-step term, is amend. These people have to make amends. These people need to, and I don't mean in an interview where you just say it. I mean, they need to, in my opinion, at least try to get with some of these aggrieved individuals and really lay it out, you know, and really find a place of just, of offering an apology, of seeking forgiveness, of you may not get it, but that's you don't control that part of it. I think anybody who's done, you know, you and I are sitting here, we've communicated on social media, we've never met before, but I'm sure you'll agree with this, for much smaller offenses than what these guys have done, right? There is an apology process that we're all familiar with.
Right.
You know, you call the person up, or you go and get face-to-face, and you offer an apology, and you either explain yourself, or you say you don't know why you did it, or whatever the truth of it is. You ask them if they hope they can forgive you. That's the only thing that's in your control, right?
Yeah.
But that is also an amazing... You know, there are countries in this world where they have, apology ceremonies for atrocities, you know, and an apology is actually a deeply meaningful thing to people. May not be enough, may not change
anything.
We've
seen a lot of bad apologies in the last few years.
Yeah. Apologies written by publicists and crisis communications teams and lawyers.
Right. But, you know, in Friedman's case, Ken Friedman's case, not
Andrew
Friedman.
Yes, thank you. No relation.
Yes. I think that there's just a skirting around of it and an attempt to just continue making money doing it. And I think that is a complete failure on his own personal part. And it's extraordinarily crass and unfeeling towards the victims involved. So, quietly, I hope he loses everything. But, yeah, that's the c'est la vie. There's a comeuppance in life, and you have to answer these things. So
now, do you have any hesitancy to say something like that?
No.
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 It's ever come back to bite you?
No. I mean...
You know what I mean. It's so...
Yeah.
It's so unusual, I think, for somebody to offer... Because this is kind of like, you know... The chef community, it's kind of like high school, right? Everybody kind of knows each other. It's, you know, a lot of people don't want to rock the boat, even with this stuff.
I mean, this.
I admire
this podcast
it.
Is called Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot, so I'm not too shy of. I just never want to say things that are reactive.
Yeah.
And not thought through. You know, I've thought long and hard that I thoroughly believe that. You know. Bobby plays an egomaniacal prick. That's what I view because of his reactions to me on what we've, you know, when we've met each other, that he's dismissive and walks away and is kind of rude. You know, but I don't feel bad saying that. I don't think it affects me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's kind of out of left field. But I don't.
Get along fine with him, but yeah.
Yeah, I don't know why. Maybe it's just competitiveness. I don't know. I don't think these things. I've always been known for relatively taking a stand and projecting my thoughts and saying what I believe in.
Yeah,
I ain't scared.
I turned a corner on that in the last year.
Right.
You know.
You're now willing to say how you truly feel?
Yeah. You know what turned the corner for me? This will sound... I haven't said this in an interview, but it's true, and maybe it'll sound corny. I hope it doesn't. When we lost Tony Bourdain.
Yeah.
I thought, you know what? That he was... I mean, among... I didn't know him well. He was so good to me if I ever needed something. We weren't like buddies. We didn't hang out.
No, I'm the same way. But he was very good to me.
He was really good to me, which I appreciate. But B, he was willing to call out BS when he saw it. And even if it was someone he had a history of friendship with. And, you know, I don't know how you felt about Josh Ozersky, but I was friends with Josh Ozersky. And Josh, whether people loved him or hated him, But, you know, he was willing to kind of lay it out there. And I feel like we've lost people who were willing to just say what they felt, you know, to call out BS where they felt.
Ozersky was interesting because I think Ozersky had a lot of detractors when he was around. And I don't think Anthony really had, Bourdain had many detractors at all. I think he was pretty much universally beloved as.
Yeah.
But he was also known to be a thoroughly puzzling human.
Yes.
Troubled human in a lot of ways.
Well, and also a provocateur.
Yeah.
I think there were times where I definitely had the impression he just woke up bored one day and decided to start a fight because it would be, you know, it'd be fun.
There are people who are very happy to call people out who they believe are affecting our industry. Kenji Lopez.
Very open.
Who is very open and somebody I respect a lot just because he's such a scientific mind when it comes to food and chefdom. And he recently opened up a place I think that's been very successful. And it's really interesting to follow him and his tweets and things like that. But he is very vehemently goes after Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah, I saw a thing the other day about Marco Pierre White.
And Marco Pierre White.
He tied that to Gordon. But, you know, Tony, to me, the moment I would have been fascinated to see, because they were friends, was when Gabrielle Hamilton stuck her toe in the water of taking over the Spotted Pig. That would have been a fascinating moment to me.
Yeah. Well,
I don't know exactly what would have happened.
I was on a panel in Aspen Food and Wine this year, and Tony had passed away a week before.
Right.
Gabrielle Hamilton was just coming up with all of the drama about her taking over the Spotted Pig without doing real due diligence, how that would affect her and her community and her partner chef. And it was probably the most uncomfortable panel I was on because Gabrielle was on it, as was Will Goddara from 11 Madison.
Yeah.
And it was just... It was a difficult, difficult thing to be involved with.
Mm-hmm.
But, I would treasure hearing Anthony's reactions to that whole kerfuffle.
I think it would have been fascinating.
Yeah. Anthony. Such a sad story. Such a brilliant mind, though. I really miss the Reader's Guide to Periodical Literature, because I could find old articles really easily.
Mm-hmm.
And I find Google is not great for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a system. And I could go look up, and then you get the microfiche. Mm-hmm. Now, if you're under 40 years old, you have no idea what I'm talking about right now.
It was like you were just speaking a different language.
And I'm
actually wondering where you're going with this.
Microfiche. Well, you talk about Alice Waters' columns in the San Francisco Express Times, which was called Alice's Restaurant.
Yes.
And those are something that I'd love to read. I just wish that somebody would republish them. So, Alice, get on that. Let's talk about the Bocuse d'Or and the idea of culinary Olympics and culinary competition in the realm of sort of like Davis Cup tennis or Davis Cup golf or whatever it is, Ryder Cup golf. The only time I really delved into the Bocuse d'Or, which is the yearly, is it every year?
Every other year.
Every other year, Culinary Olympiad held in Lyon, France. I was working on a ancillary show to then Top Chef Masters that was called Battle of the Sous Chefs. And it was a online show, and I would do it very, very late at night in L.A., and I was out there for about a month working on it. And so I came home one night, and I had been up for 24 hours straight, and I was extraordinarily strung out, not because of drugs, just because of exhaustion.
Tired. Yeah.
And so I bring up online a live feed to the Bocuse d'Or. And for the next 6 hours straight, I just tweeted nonsense about the Bocuse d'Or. And in reading it the next couple of days, it was the strangest commentary I could ever come up with. But it was kind of funny and kind of interesting. But I find the Bocuse d'Or to be, it's interesting to me. It's so frenetic, but it's so goofy as well.
Mm-hmm.
It's like these masterful platters that are like 10 feet by 12 feet of like fish carvings and stuff like that, that show definite acumen for food and the top, you know, techniques of chefdom. But does it matter?
Well, I think it depends who you're talking to. Well, first of all, if you're a European chef, that it's still a big deal over there.
It's huge over there.
It's huge. I mean, there was a guy, Rasmus Kofed, who won bronze came back, and the training, I mean, the commitment to training is crazy.
It's, yeah, they recreate the whole kitchen for you, and you
But you spend months and months and months and months. But he won bronze once, and then he came back 2 years later and got silver. Took a year, took a competition off, then came back and won the gold. This guy suited up three times and amazingly did better each time. You know, I interviewed a guy from Australia when I was doing my book who had placed 12th, wanted to come back, went through the whole thing again, came back. You know what he placed? 12th again.
All for that. So
so for Europeans, it's a huge deal. Leah Lindstrom, you know, this chef from, why am I blanking? Anyway, European chef. She still has, or at least did last I checked, was still serving the menu that won her the award at the second Bocuse d'Or in the late 1980s.
So this
at
is her like restaurant. 30, or 30 years
at
later.
At her restaurant. Still serving it. Still a thing.
Yeah, that's great. So I did a show in Canada called Iron Chef Canada. And it's a newer rendition of Iron Chef. And I was one of the Iron Chefs. And so the second competition, I'm facing this guy named Alex Chen, who's in Vancouver, and he was the head of the Canadian contingent of Bocuse d'Or, and I think they placed sixth or fifth or something like that. I had no idea. So who this guy was. Mm-hmm. I had no idea he was led the Bocuse d'Or team for the Canadians. We start this culinary competition for an hour on Iron Chef. This guy was a maniac. I felt like I was, you know, playing with Duplo blocks on the other side as this guy was creating, yeah, like, you know, thermonuclear dynamics.
It's incredible what they do. I wrote this book, Knives at Dawn, about the Bocuse d'Or. The guy who was competing for the U.S. that year was Timothy Hollingsworth. He's the main character in my book, who was just on the final table.
Who was the chef de cuisine under Thomas Keller at the French Laundry for years.
And now has Otium in L.A.
Yeah, Otium in L.A. And is a gem of a human, too.
Yeah, so. No, Timmy was great. But, you know, to the Americans, I think what's interesting, when you go generationally, this actually ties back to my book in a funny way, because the relationship with the French was so fraught, right? I think there was such an inferiority complex among chefs of Keller's era. You know, I asked him which point blank, because we've now won the gold. Right? And I said, did you ever think you would be over there representing the American team and winning medals, you know? And he said, never. Like, it was, he couldn't have even imagined that when he was a young cook, you know, going over there and getting the treatment you got as a young American. I mean, young Americans got treated terribly in French kitchens.
You know, they were the peelers of the onions.
You know, but not just that. Like, at staff meal, there are all these stories like, you know, you'd sit down to staff dinner and somebody would stick a bottle of ketchup next to you, you know, or they'd give you a can of Coke and say, this is Vin American, you know, or they would call you Ronald Reagan.
Boy, you know? I can't think of suffering through abuses like that.
Stop.
That seems pretty soft, but yeah.
But I mean, to go from that to like going, so I think for somebody like Thomas to go over there as the president of the American Foundation,
right,
come back with gold is a huge thing. I'm a little puzzled, although they tell me, people like Gavin Kazin, who's very involved, and, you know, Phil Tessier, who got the silver, who's still involved in a coaching capacity.
And Danielle is still very involved.
Yeah, these people all tell me it's very meaningful to them. I don't really know why the younger generation cares that much, because I don't feel like we need that kind of validation anymore. As Americans,
I think that
we have three Michelin star restaurants. We have people coming from Europe to stage at a place like Alinea. You know, why do we need that like pat on the back? You know, why do we need that seal of approval?
It may have jumped the shark, so to speak. Well, this food was phenomenal at Gotham Bar and Grill. So classic. And the steak just has this beautiful char to it. So what does this food evoke to you? What's the...
Well, so I was going to thank you for that. So, you know, the first person who ever hired me to write anything was Alfred. Alfred Bortale, who's the chef here at Gotham. I was his publicist. I was trying to be a screenwriter back in the 90s. And I had a day job working for a PR firm. Alfred and the Gotham were one of my clients. He knew I was trying to be a writer. And he let me co-write with him the Gotham Bar and Grill cookbook, which I thought would be a one-time lark. This is what indirectly, over the years, led to me doing what I do now. And we would work downstairs in the office at night here. And this was when I first started to get my look at the inner workings of sort of the chef world. You know, I'd be down there with Alfred interviewing. Periodically, a sous chef would sometimes come in with a dry run of a new dish that Alfred had kind of sketched out.
Chef, taste this.
Taste this. And Alfred would give them feedback. I would get to taste it. I thought that was really cool. And more often than not, we would end the night by having dinner. Sometimes we would go to another restaurant. But very often at 9:50 or 9:55, we would run up to the dining room and we would be the last order in.
And you would be that ticket
and,
that comes in at the very end of the
service. Yes, but we didn't do it after 10. You know, they sat till 10. And almost always it was a 2 half-orders of pasta, whatever the pasta of the day was, and a steak split. So this is an incredibly evocative dinner for me. And also, the PR firm, we're on 12th Street here in the city. The PR firm I worked for was on 20th Street. And my shabby little rent-controlled one-bedroom apartment with mice was on 8th Street. So this
which he will sublet to you for $8,000 a month.
But this was on my walk. This was on my walk home. I mean, this restaurant was to me. I mean, I come in here, and it's like I did 3 books with Alfred. So I had this exact meal we're having a million times, never during the day. You know, but also, you know, I know every inch of this place. I'd be totally comfortable. Nobody in the kitchen would know me anymore, but walking through the kitchen back to the office to say hi to the staff, some of whom are, I'm sure, still there. And, yeah, so it's just...
But that's what great restaurants should have.
It's a real homecoming for me.
I mean, back to the real point of a restaurant. It's a place of respite.
Yes.
And this is just such an iconic one. So thanks for setting this up.
Oh, please. Thanks for having me on your first season.
Yeah. Well, you guys, everybody should go buy and read Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, which is out in hardcover and in paperback pretty much now. And because it's a great read. And listen to Andrew's podcast as well. But Andrew Friedman, thanks for being on.
Thanks for having me here.
Awesome.
I hope we stirred the pot.
We did.
This episode of Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot was taped on location by Brian Blum at Gotham Bar and Grill in Greenwich Village. You should go. Scott Porch produces the show, and Mackenzie Mazzell edited this episode. You can follow Hugh Atchison Stirs the Pot on Apple Podcasts, the Himalaya app, or wherever you listen to podcasts. If you like what you hear, please rate, review, and come back on Tuesdays for a new episode. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Hugh Atchison, where I am endlessly... not that fascinating, but, you know, caustic and weird. Thanks for listening. Eat well. Peace well.